This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance for Europeans and people of European descent, no matter where they might live on the earth, and certainly this program is important for all people. I'm going to preface the continuation of my book, Jewish Supremacism, in audio format, the 14th chapter, the final chapter, by saying that this book and this broadcast and my website is not anti-Semitic. I don't like to discuss what we are, quote, not, but it's so important to make clear these points and to make clear what we are to people rather than simply accept the definitions that are given us by a lot of the popular and mainstream media. I don't think it's anti-Semitic to make legitimate criticisms of the state of Israel, a supremacist state, an apartheid state, and a criminal state, a state that's committed massive war crimes against innocent civilians such as in Lebanon, has committed terrible atrocities such as mass torture, kidnapping and torture of tens of thousands of Palestinians and other Middle Eastern peoples. And I don't think it's anti-Semitism to criticize the elements of Jewish extremism, of Jewish supremacism, that exist around the world. It's okay to expose, quote, white supremacism, and which I certainly don't agree with or don't endorse in any way. I believe in equal rights for all. I believe in the preservation of my European and American heritage, but I certainly don't believe in opposing other people, oppressing them, or trying to rule over others. The idea that I believe in is freedom. But the issue, truly, is not anti-Semitism. The issue is the fact that there is an incredible extremist viewpoint that exists among many powerful Jews in the world who have a lot of power in both media and government, and they're putting forth these extremist positions into effect by their influence of policies around the world. In America, the Jewish neocons, radical Jewish supremacists, radical Zionists, are literally dictating American foreign policy. And they're leading America on a course that's disastrous for both the people of the United States of America. We're rising tremendous hatred and terrorism against us. It's costing us billions of dollars, and it's costing us the blood of our sons and daughters in Iraq and elsewhere. And it's certainly not helping the people of Iraq and the rest of the world either. And we must confront these elements. We must discuss these elements. And it's kind of interesting whenever you expose elements of Jewish extremism or supremacism, you will be the one that's called a supremacist. You will be the one that's called an extremist. And that's not at all of what I'm about are the people who help produce DavidDuke.com and the David Duke Report and do the work that we're doing. We're about the preservation of our own heritage. And we're opposed to any sort of supremacism or compulsion against any people, including our own. But we certainly believe that the greatest threat to world peace and the greatest instigator of so-called terrorism and the so-called clash of civilization has been Israel. So we will continue on now with the third section of the final chapter of my book, Jewish Supremacism, in audio format. And I'll be with you again in a few moments. At the end of this section, here we go. To resist assimilation by the much larger societies in which they lived, Jews developed a theology that fostered the belief that they were a superior people, a chosen by God people, and a people made separate from other peoples, with a divinely ordained right to rule the world, accompanied by a sacred obligation to keep both their culture and genotype pure. Non-Jews were characterized as unclean inferiors and often as murderous foes determined to destroy them either by extermination, as commemorated annually in Passover or Purim, or by assimilation, as commemorated in the celebrations of Hanukkah. To survive as a minority in other nations, often as newcomers with little or no land and a religious cultural disdain for physical labor, they needed to develop skills in other areas. They became proficient at usury, finance and administration, and legal as well as criminal forms of enterprise. They discovered that with an altruistic team effort, they could come to dominate important areas of Gentile social structure. It also became apparent that it was in their interest to maintain an ethnocentric team strategy and at the same time to weaken Gentile team strategy and Gentile solidarity. They also developed complex strategies of deception in order to hide their extreme ethnocentrism from their Gentile hosts. By the end of their Babylonian captivity, a period of hundreds of years during which they flourished as a powerful minority in an alien nation, their Judaic strategy had developed into a fine art which they finally codified in the Talmud. Jews developed distinct cultural, dietary, and ritual traditions to keep them separate from Gentiles, distinct from the other two major world religions. Judaism sought no converts, and although ostensibly permitting conversion, they erected barriers making conversion difficult. The Jewish community did not fully accept converts or even their descendants. Many rabbis in Jewish scripture says it takes 10 generations or more in the Jewish community to be fully accepted, and Jewish law refers to offspring of the converted as, quote, bastards. The vast majority of Jews who outmarried did so with non-converted Gentiles and thus faced expulsion from the Jewish community. A Jewish historian writes of the descendants of conversion even within Judaism, and I quote, in other words, he was deprived of civil and political rights to which every Israelite had claim, even those such as bastards who were of seriously blemished descent, unquote. As a cohesive minority in Gentile nations, Jews needed to hide their true ethnocentric beliefs. One aid to that process was their preservation of the Hebrew language among their scholars and their limiting of translations of their texts into the Gentile languages. As documented in my Roots of Jewish Supremacism chapter, in modern times, they even developed code words to distinguish the more hateful anti-Gentile quotations in their Talmud and their rituals, even to the extent of publishing companion guides in Israel to the Talmud showing Jewish students the real anti-Gentile meaning of the disguised terms. Jews also learned to usually make themselves as politically cryptic as possible, often content to direct policies from behind the scenes so as not to awaken Gentile ire. In these endeavors, they often failed to restrain their rapaciousness, sometimes leading to violent anti-Semitic reactions. The Judaic community has historically emphasized education and highly praised Jewish scholarship of the Talmud, rewarding such scholarship with prestige and economic security. Such policies had a profound impact on their genotype. Just as favoring the best scholars favored those with high verbal IQs, so a number of other aspects of their social structure favored other traditional Jewish characteristics. J. Philippe Rushton, in his groundbreaking 1995 book, Race, Evolution, and Behavior, has shown in studies of data dealing with twin research that even tendencies toward group altruism and ethnocentrism have strong genetic components. Jewish law has for hundreds of generations expelled Jews who have assimilated with Gentiles, thus removing them from their gene pool. Such policies would certainly strengthen any Jewish predisposition to ethnocentrism by removing those who had a more conciliatory attitude or even attraction to Gentile aesthetics or values. As the Jews became more proficient at usury, monopolistic business practices, tax collecting, criminal enterprises, and acting as oppressive intermediaries in the administrations of occupational governments, increased Gentile reactionary anti-Semitism reinforced the siege mentality of the Jewish people. Their antipathy toward their Gentile hosts encouraged Jewish communities to support foreign military incursions and occupation of the nations in which they lived. And such actions, in turn, spawned greater animosity toward Jews, deepening the vicious cycle that continues to the present day. Jews reacted to the threat of assimilation by becoming more ethnocentric. In sharp contrast, living in their mostly homogeneous communities in the heart of Europe, our ancestors never developed the siege mentality of the Jews. As trade, slavery, and foreign immigration increased into Europe, most European communities were ill-prepared for the introduction of powerful ethnocentric minorities within their borders. Gentile societies of the ancient world often permitted various religious expressions, including tolerance of the Jewish faith, whereas the Jewish people demanded strict adherence to their faith within the confines of their society. The Jewish community has continued through the centuries as an authoritarian society that has continually and consciously promoted Jewish cohesion. Even during the Middle Ages, many Jewish communities exercised the death penalty for those Jews deemed to have betrayed Jewish interests. The execution of Jesus is a perfect example of the eradication of one who they felt was a threat to their homogeneity. Other historic tools used to maintain their ideological and genetic purity were excommunication and expulsion. While Europeans coming from a less competitive, homogeneous society endorsed a live and let live, more individualistic ethic, Jews maintained an intense collectivism. In modern times, Jews have strengthened their networks of communication and solidarity while supporting the fragmentation of Gentile values and Gentile societies. To thrive in a small minority in an alien society also requires a talent for deceit. In Christian Spain of the Middle Ages, Jews responded to demands for Christian conversion by becoming Marranos, supposed converts to Christianity who secretly practiced Judaism. They developed elaborate schemes of deception that have lasted for centuries. Many secret Jews successfully deceived their Gentile hosts as to their true anti-Christian beliefs. The most convincing Marranos thrived and prospered, while those less skilled in such duplicity often suffered or perished in the Inquisition and other persecutions. So Jews developed patterns of dual morality, one morality for themselves and their kin, and another for their Gentile hosts. Conversely, Gentiles in the homogeneous societies of Europe tended to develop a single morality that favored assimilation when alien populations immigrated to their lands or when they conquered other nations. Ancient Greece exemplified that tradition by carrying a doctrine of universalism to their conquered lands. Some of the same values of within-race altruism that Jews revered for themselves also existed among European populations. However, because no non-European races were present, there was no need to develop intricate competitive or deceptive group strategies so characteristic of the Jewish nation. In the day-to-day commerce and social interaction of Europe, truthfulness was honored as a standard for daily life. In times of war, a more dual type of morality arose, differentiating the interests of one's own people from that of the enemy. Yet, the normal course of affairs involved interchange and commerce primarily among one's own kind rather than among alien people. Thus, our people never learned well the art of dual morality, except in the exigencies of war. The migration and presence of alien Jewish elements contributed greatly to the modern development of European racial consciousness. Next section is the present state of Jewry. Churchill put it succinctly in 1920 when he described the Jewish takeover of Russia as having, quote, gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and become the masters of this enormous empire, unquote. In the last decade of the 20th century, they grip America in a similar way. They thoroughly dominate the news and entertainment media in almost every Western nation. They control the international markets and stock exchanges, and no government can resist doing their bidding on any issue of importance. They can coalesce against any state that resists their power, such as they did in the economic extortion of $1 billion from Switzerland, or the way they orchestrated the invasion of Iraq. The cohesion of the Jewish people is indeed the context of the New World Order, and under its auspices, they are attempting to extend their totalitarian denial of free speech from Europe and Canada to the nation that was once the most free in the world, the United States. Those who openly state the facts of Jewish power are often called believers in the, quote, Jewish conspiracy, as if to conjure the ridiculous image of Jews in kaftans and yarmulkes peering from behind their earlocks at candlelit globes as they plot world domination. But it's not the fanciful learned elders of Zion that we have to fear. It's those who wield Jewish power today ever more brazenly. There is no conspiracy, at least not in the usual sense of the term. There is not even too much secrecy about it. Jewish power is ubiquitous. Every politician is so aware of their power that he knows he cannot dare mention it. Jewish organizations, Jewish media, and Jewish political agents ruthlessly advance their agenda, remorselessly and without introspection. Just as they single-mindedly once orchestrated the Russian Revolution, now they coordinate their world power. No Jewish leader needs to direct his minions to seek political control over Gentile nations. Jewish supremacists do it as naturally as the blue jay appropriates another bird's nest. Jewish media bosses and government bureaucrats don't have to be told to destroy Gentile pride or heritage, honor, loyalty, tradition, while simultaneously defending their own. There is no necessity of a master plan to corrupt Gentile sexual mores, family structure, and religious beliefs. Freud and his intellectual descendants and media purveyors have certainly needed no plan. They just did what came natural to them. No learned elders of Zion has to tell the Jewish bureaucrats to open America's and Europe's borders to the wretched refuse of the world. They know almost instinctively that in nations of diversity, they can dominate. They also know that if they can destroy our genetic integrity and ethnic solidarity, that there will be few people with the solidarity needed to effectively challenge their rule. No, it's not an intricate conspiracy. It's simply, it's two nations, Jew and Gentile, in a state of ethnic war. Of course, most Jews and Gentiles do not even realize that we are at war. But while we Gentiles are unknowingly taught cultural and political suicide, Jewish supremacists teach their kind an ethnic allegiance of their own kind and a hatred and mistrust of us. Only a small portion of Jews are on the cultural and political front lines, but through many Jewish organizations, the home front definitely supports its stormtroops. Of course, there have been Jews who have decried the hypocrisies of the supremacists. Some have even risked their own lives to warn Gentiles about the Zionist danger. Such men include Noam Chomsky, Benjamin Friedman, Alfred Lilienthal, Israel Shahak, and Norman Finkelstein, five men of Jewish descent who realize that Zionist extremism can lead them to disaster. The peace movement in Israel harbors many such Jews. Some Jews, while still desiring preservation of their own genotype, seek a policy of peaceful separation and coexistence rather than Zionist absolutism. They realized that Jewish supremacism may eventually destroy them. Although we understand the Jewish supremacist character of both Judaism and Zionism, we do acknowledge that there are individual Jews who embrace neither doctrine and who are not engaged in any kind of activity to corrupt or destroy Gentile institutions. A good example was the life of Israel Shahak, a Jewish survivor of Nazi concentration camps and a professor in Israel who greatly suffered for daring to speak out about Zionism and Talmudic Judaism. He told the world about the Jewish misanthropy, not only on behalf of justice for Gentiles, but also to save his own people from the consequences of these actions. Jews such as Israel Shahak offer a hope of a mutually beneficial resolution of the Jewish-Gentile conflict, but Shahak and those like him remain a despised, tiny minority among their brethren. Fair resolution of the conflict can surely never come from Jewish hegemony. Only after we depose Jewish supremacist power in our own nations can we negotiate with them successfully. At this point in the conflict, although an ethnic peace conference would be the best solution for all parties, history tells us that it's extremely unlikely to occur. Tyrannies defer only to greater power. If they truly represented what is noble in man, perhaps it would be in the order of nature to have our people replaced by the Jewish extremist prototype. However, history reveals that in the sweep of history, Jewish supremacists have far more been harbingers of darkness than of light. This is revealed in the tragic implementation of the doctrines of the three most influential Jews of the 19th and 20th centuries, Marx, Freud, and Boas. These three Jews came to debase mankind, not to ennoble it, and their doctrines have brought incredible damage and terrible suffering to humanity. Jews have enormous power, a power born of talent coupled with unscrupulousness. They are strengthened by that which weakens us. Our power can reassert itself only from dedication to truth and justice, from expressions of courage and nobility. And when we violate our own morality, we grow weakened and exploitable as we are now. Somewhere in our genotype stirs our genes for survival, and those genes are now expressing themselves in a new awakening. I see this awakening wherever our people are. It is especially strong in our young. It is a vision that persecution and hatred cannot destroy. Somewhere at this moment, another fair baby sleeps peacefully in his cradle, unaware of the great battle now raging for his right to grow up and live in his own land and by the values and spiritual qualities of his own people. I hope that you find this chapter to be extremely fascinating and informative. Remember that all the citations and the evidence that I muster here in this book, you can read for yourself in the printed form of my book, Jewish Supremacism, or the downloadable version, which is also available for from davidduke.com. Ladies and gentlemen, it's just amazing, I think, as we continue to expose this virulent form of racial supremacism that exists in the world, and it exists with very little criticism. I remember the criticism that went against South Africa for years, a torrent of criticism, disinvestment, sanctions, and here you have a state of Israel that commits war crimes against its neighbors. You know, we went to war against Saddam Hussein because he invaded Kuwait, which was an old part of Iraq, and they had some very legitimate conflicts there in terms of the oil resources. Kuwait was drilling at an angle into Iraq, underneath Iraq territory, and it eventually went to war. But we went to war against Iraq ostensibly for invading its neighbor unjustly, and yet that's precisely what Israel did in terms of Lebanon. attacked a country that was friendly to the United States of America, a nation where 25,000 Americans lived and worked. And we literally not only allowed Israel to do this, but we basically gave Israel complicit support in that action. It's horrendous, ladies and gentlemen, absolutely horrendous. But this book, I think, Jewish Supremacism, is helping many to understand the political realities of the world and to understand the tremendous power of these supremacists in media and government. And I believe if we continue to work and speak out honestly and openly and decently without hatred or rancor, but simply with love and decency and a love for truth and honesty and fairness in the world, I think if we continue to do so, we can expose these extremists and hopefully take them out of power, that we can remove them from the nexus of power both in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere. Thanks so much for being with me. And again, tomorrow will be our final part, the final part of the final chapter of my audiobook, Jewish Supremacism. This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.davidduke.com.